Here's Graceland with Jennifer Meadows.
Well, President Obama attacks Fox News at a panel on poverty at Georgetown University on Tuesday. Now, Obama says this concept about poor people being lazy and the fact that they don't want to work is being propagated by Fox News on a regular basis. Now, he says, so the answer, as far as his opinion goes, is that we're going to have to change how media reports on these issues. So Obama's big government policies, those are not the problem. The media, and in particular, Fox News, is the problem. But thank you for listening to Graceland on WNJC 1360 and from our TK Radio Network studio. I'm Jennifer Meadows. And our guest today is Susan Knowles, who is a contributor to The Blaze. Susan is an author and investigative journalist who makes regular appearances on The Rick Amato Show on the One America News Network. Our discussion will be about the new developments to the Department of Veterans Affairs since the VA scandal of 2013. And then at the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking about Obama's latest attack on Fox News. And we actually do not have our co-host that is in our second half hour. Charles Johnson will be back with us next week. But right now, I'm here with my co-host and journalist, Curtis Mang. So, Curtis, according to the president, Fox News, he is the real problem when we're talking about poverty in America. So he says we need to change how media reports on these issues.
It is fascinating. So basically, as far as Barack Obama goes, in other words, Fox News actually reports on how lousy his economic policies are. Therefore, they need to be quiet about it.
Yeah, you know, Obama wouldn't want to take responsibility for any of that because it's not his problem. You know, he's out on the golf course. He's on vacation. Don't worry with him with these problems, you know, even though he is the president. So.
Certainly. It's like he just showed up, like he hasn't been in office for the last 6.5 years.
He's the drive-by president. That's what he is. It's kind of there. You see him, you hear him all the time. Actually, you hear him maybe a little too much. But you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
He's that guy in the White House. You wish he'd kind of go away. But
soon he will, but not soon enough.
But we're waiting on our guest for this evening, Susan. Susan, can you hear me?
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Now, we're going to be talking about the VA, you know, refreshing everybody's memory, going back to the VA scandal of 2013. And you wrote an article today for The Blaze, so it was good timing there, Susan. Basically, fill us in. Has anything in a positive or negative manner, what has changed since the VA scandal?
Well, as you might recall, and it's been a while, and we seem to forget things very quickly, but you know, back in 2013, we had this huge scandal where all of the veterans that were trying to get into the VA hospital, a lot of them were dying because of these extended wait periods, and you know, they were put on lists and everything else. We got rid of Eric Shinseki, who was the director at that time. And so it kind of went away in the news, you know, just one of those things that kind of swept under the carpet and we're hoping it's kind of got better and went away. Well, in fact, things don't look so good right now. And there may be another scandal that's brewing at the VA even as we speak. Recently, the House Veterans Affairs Committee Chairman Jeff Miller, who is Republican from Florida, accused the current VA Secretary Robert McDonnell of basically making false statements to the media about the number of individuals that had been terminated due to this big scandal. And, you know, that's one of the things that he promised. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to get rid of these people that have, you know, caused all the problems. We're just going to start again. So that's kind of what's brewing right now.
Well, I thought what was interesting from reading your article is we heard that there were all these firings or all these people that were let go, and they said they removed as many as 900 people. But tell me, Susan, did that occur?
Well, you know, it's funny, too. I think under this administration, we have a way of using words. It's what progressives do best. We use a different word, and we can always say, oh, no, I didn't mean that. It meant something else. But what Mr. McDonald, and again, that's the VA secretary, what he said was, and I quote, "We're making fundamental changes in the department in terms of leadership. We have held accountable about 900 employees who are no longer with us." You know, I don't know what that really means, but to me that would mean that they're gone and fired.
But you know what? Not to be funny, but in a state or federal employees that might not be with us, that could be a lot of people.
Yeah, that could be. Well, and then,
what does
you know,
that mean? They're checked out. They're out to lunch. I don't know.
Could be anywhere, on vacation, permanent leave, you know, whatever. But he went on to say that they'd had specifically removed 60 people, and he said 60 people were fired, and those were those pertaining to the ones that had manipulated the wait time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this would have been bought in the media, no problems, except for one little tiny thing, and that was an internal VA document which showed that the actual number of people that had been removed were only three. And really what it boils a whole three people. And what happens is when it boils down to it, there was really zero that were removed because of the three, one was fired for accepting gifts improperly, which really had nothing to do with the wait time. One retired, and I guess we could call that a firing. and one was involved in a pending termination. So basically zero.
Oh my goodness! You know, this sounds so much like government. I guess if you want to stay on the payroll forever and ever, then look for a federal government job. I think that's the takeaway from this story. But this today we are talking to Susan Knowles, and Susan is an attorney. She's an author and host of her own show right here on WNJC 1360. And she makes regular guest appearances on the Rick Amato Show on One America News Network. And Susan's also a regular contributor to The Blaze. And Susan, I'm here with my co-host, Curtis Meng. And Curtis, I guess if you can get government work, it's a great place to be, I suppose.
Well, it certainly is. I think, you know, great hours, longevity. You have job security until you die, and maybe even beyond that. I don't know. Susan, it's interesting that you mentioned the one firing for accepting gifts improperly. That actually happened to be, I believe, Sharon Hellman, who was the director of the VA hospital in Phoenix, who is now suing to get her job back. Which I find incredible, and I don't know what the odds are of getting her job back, but it seems incredible that someone can get fired from the VA or any federal bureaucracy and sue to get their jobs back in such a manner. But I'm interested in kind of more of a general, and we'll get back to the VA specifically, but your thoughts generally, and I think we touched on it a little bit, from a bureaucratic standpoint overall, is the problem with the VA as far as you know, making and holding people accountable. Is that really a problem with just the VA, or is that something systemic with government bureaucracies generally?
Well, I think it's probably systemic, and I think under this administration, it's even more of a problem. I mean, look at the role models that we have. We have people who, you know, wipe their computers clean, mm-hmm. you know, and we have emails that are lost, and we have, you know, all kinds of things that are coming out and being said, and nobody seems to question them. Nobody has to really talk in front of being brought in front of an administration hearing. Nobody talks, so we just say, oh, well, Fifth Amendment, which they have a right to do, but then they go on and say, but I'm innocent, you know, and they start talking, but only the questions that they want to answer.
Right.
I'm not surprised that somebody would do something like that, and they'll say, hey, you know, everybody else has gotten away with it. Why can't I have my job back?
And that's a very good point, and it's, you know, it's really no different than, you know, you're raising your kids, and, you know, the kid across the street gets away with, you know, staying out till 10 o'clock at night, and your kid wants to ask the same thing. Why can't I stay out till 10 o'clock at night? I agree with you. I think it is systemic, and I guess my next question, I'm asking you to kind of think like a liberal, which you know, maybe rather hard. It's certainly hard for me. You know, given that this does seem to be systemic, that there are, you know, problems with large bureaucracies. You know, why do Barack Obama and others on the left, you know, want them to be bigger and greater? I don't understand that concept.
Well, it's just the progressive way of doing things. You know, they always believe that bigger government is better. And it doesn't matter if you do your job well in that big organization. The fact is, you know, it's like Obama always says, we've got jobs out there. We're giving people jobs. Well, we're giving people some jobs, but nothing's getting done. And we've seen that. I mean, where have there been improvements? You know, please point that out to me.
Right.
I haven't seen it. Government just keeps getting bigger, and everything just keeps getting worse.
That's a very good point. Apparently, you know, results don't matter. I've often said, you know, to a liberal, results are for saps, because you can point to instances where the results are poor, and yet they blame, what do they traditionally blame? Well, lack of funds, for example. Well, you know, would increased funds, and I guess that's a good question, is, you know, has anything been done from a funding standpoint since the VA scandal in 2013 to alleviate some of these problems, or is it a funding issue at all?
I don't necessarily know that it's a funding issue. I think it is just a poorly run organization that has been run poorly for as long as I can remember. And we're not talking about them really making major changes. I haven't really heard anything new. You know, let's say we get rid of some people. Okay, that's really not going to resolve the issue.
Uh-huh.
It's not run properly. And it's interesting because the first thing that the VA secretary came back with, you know, what he's mad about is the fact that confidential VA information was leaked. Otherwise, what that means is, You called me on my misstatements and my bluff, and now
yeah.
I don't like it. Okay, so here we are again. Let's do everything in secret. Let's not do anything different, and we'll just call it different until the next time we have to do another investigation because things aren't going well again.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan, I kind of want to get away from, you know, some of those issues and really kind of talk about the personal toll that's happening to veterans and their families. And you mentioned a tragic story in your article on The Blaze today. So why don't you tell us about that story and then maybe, you know, fill us in with how is this affecting people's lives, these wait times? You know, we're not serving our veterans. I think it's tragic. This is a tragic situation because we've got so much money being funneled into the VA, but yet it's not trickling down to the people that need those services.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, you had mentioned, I'm a former practicing attorney, but I'm also a licensed psychotherapist. And, you know, I've seen a lot of individuals that come back and they have issues with PTSD, and they're having really long wait times with the VA, and they're just not getting the help that they need. And a lot of people, unfortunately, we hear this almost on a daily basis, they're committing suicide because they just, they don't know how to handle it. They know that there's an organization that is not giving them what they need. And I think it's kind of like, well, what else am I going to do? And what happened recently was just another case where a veteran basically pulled into the parking lot of the Department of Veterans Affairs in Phoenix, in the regional office there in Phoenix, Arizona. A witness was watching him, and he heard this crack, you know, this big loud crack noise, and mm-hmm. he kind of went over to investigate to see what happened. And when he did, he found a man laying just outside of his vehicle with a gun nearby, and he had apparently shot himself and killed himself right there.
Oh my God! I mean, and this is just one of so many examples of things that are happening. And here we have so much money being funneled into the VA, and yet it's not getting to the people that need the services. So we have all this administration, and yet it's not getting to our veterans. And like the scandal we saw back in 2013, these long wait lines, and you're dealing with people that have, you know, physical problems, but they also have psychological needs as well. And so we're certainly failing our veterans. You know, what is the solution? Well, what is the solution to this issue? I mean, we've got so much bureaucracy and red tape, and it seems like this whole system needs to be streamlined. And when, you know, we talked about 900 people were going to be reprimanded, and it sounded like they were going to be let go, I would say at minimum we need to remove that many people. And I think wouldn't it be great if we could come up with a solution in the private sector that could meet these needs of our veterans?
Well, absolutely, and I think that's typically the best way to resolve any issue like that, is you take it out of the hands of government that has a lot of bureaucracy, that does things totally different than a business that is for profit, and you let that business kind of see what they can do and run this well, but I know that they could do. And it has to be changed. Again, it's not a matter of just removing people. When you have the same system and that system is broken, it's not going to change. I mean, this poor man, from what I understand, he was a 53-year-old man. He was receiving like $130 a month in benefits and living in a shelter. You know, I mean, obviously, just kind of looking at those facts, you know, he's not getting the help that he needs. And it's such a shame to have our vets go out and serve knowing, you know, that they may come back from wherever, Iraq or whatever, you know, war of the week that we have, and they're going to come back to a system that's not going to provide well for them, and they do it anyway. And then we don't give them what they deserve for serving our country honorably.
And it's appalling. You know, here was a veteran who went out and he served his country and then came back, and that's what he received, $130 a month. And I don't know this person's what other income he might have had, but he was living at a homeless shelter. And so how many people do you know that could live off of that kind of meager salary? And he may have had some other programs, but, you know, we are certainly failing our veterans. And with that, Curtis, I'm going to let you ask the last question, and then we're going to move into our next topic.
Well, and just to follow up on that real briefly, and Susan, you may have a comment on this, that, you know, in 2012, the VA did its own study. Indicates that suicides among military veterans average 22 per day. That study, mm-hmm. I think, covered suicides from 1999 to 2010. So what, from the VA's perspective, are they doing to try and alleviate some of these problems that veterans have? Because that number of 22 per day is shocking.
Well, and I do know, you know, again, being a psychotherapist, I've been contacted by some organizations that want civilians, you know, to go on the military bases and help out in that respect in mental health services. But they put so many restrictions on the psychotherapists that come in. You know, you're not even allowed to call yourself a psychotherapist. I mean, that the rules are just, you're laughable. It's like, let's get down and solve the problem. Let's stop being, you know, politically correct or whatever, you know, thing that you want to call it. Let's just solve the issue. And I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're at that point where we can do it. And in fact, you know, subpoenas have been issued by the Republican that I was talking about in the House Veterans Affairs Committee, and according to what he said, there's no response. There's been stonewalling, and nobody's coming forward and giving them the information that they want. You can't have a system, you know, that's going to work if you're not willing to allow people to look at it and make corrections where corrections are needed.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And like I reiterated a little while ago, I mean, it would really be nice to see, say, a private sector solution to this. And, of course, you know, I don't know what that would take to have that happen. But wouldn't it be great if veterans could just go and get these services from local hospitals? Mm-hmm. I mean, where you could have average wait times. And for God's sake, you know, these are people who risk their lives. You know, for us, for you, for me, I think that's the least we could do. And then we could remove no telling how much red tape and bureaucracy and money for the American taxpayer. But I don't know, Susan, if that is possible. I just don't know. So
probably isn't under Obamacare. So,
yes.
You're right. Well, today we are talking to Susan Knowles, who is an attorney. She's an author and host of her own show here on WNJC 1360. Now, she makes regular appearances on the Rick Amato Show on the One America News Network. And Susan's also a regular contributor to The Blaze. And let's move into a new topic, talking about Michelle Obama. I think this is Curtis's favorite topic. he just loves it. But,
certainly.
Anyway, but she's back. She's always in the news. She's back in the news and was at, I believe it was a museum opening, and was invited to speak at this opening. It was there in New York City, the Whitney Museum. So, Susan, tell us, you know, now she got to speak during this opening. So what was Michelle Obama's uplifting message to people that showed up?
Her uplifting message is you're going to fail. You're not good enough and you're going to fail.
Yeah.
Isn't that usually her message to everyone?
Yes, true.
Uplifting message.
Yes.
In fact, I wrote an article about it called Divided We Stand, United We Fall. It's just the opposite of what it should be, you know, where she goes to this really expensive, exclusive museum. And I don't know about you two, but I didn't get my invitation in the mail, so it must have gotten
lost.
Darn it,
I was waiting by my mailbox, and I was so disappointed because it didn't come. So
I know, because
Curtis, did you get yours?
No, I didn't, but I guarantee you that there were armed guards to make sure I did not enter, so...
but you know, again, while she's standing there at the museum, she's complaining because, you know, there are so many kids in this world who, like herself, you know, would look at this museum and say, you know, this is not someplace I could go. It's not for me. Basically, I'm not good enough to go there because I'm, you know, I'm a minority. And she claims that, you know, when she was a child, she felt the same way. And it, again, you know, it's one of those messages where if I were sitting there as a child, and I, you know, I hate to tell Michelle, but she's got daughters who are in exclusive private schools. I didn't go to an exclusive private school. She has an ability to globetrot around the world with her children. And I don't know that many kids in the world who get to do that. So for her to sort of sit there and give the message that you can't do this, you're going to fail, it's just horrible, you know, every negative thought you could get, it was there, is beyond me. I mean, she had a golden opportunity to sit there and tell minority kids, you can overcome anything you want. Just look at me. Look at my husband. Look at what we've done. He's president of the United States. I'm first lady. If we can do it, so can you.
So I guess afterwards, everybody was hitting the cash bar, probably, for a couple of shots. It's like, God, you know, let's pick it up a little bit. Come on, you know. So what the takeaway is, hey, museums are racist, I guess, Curtis.
That seems to be the takeaway. I think you're correct. And I think Michelle Obama seems to feel alienated. And therefore, if she feels alienated, then that is reflective of the entire nation. And Susan, I have to ask you that when Barack Obama was elected in 2008, I thought we were going to be entering the post-racial America. What happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what we entered was the Reverend Wright era. I think, you know, sitting and listening to Reverend Wright view his hatred for all those years, and being a racist, you know, the racist words that came out of his mouth for 20 years, I think it influenced Obama, and I think that he came into the White House with this image of, I'm going to tell it the way I see it, and he has really been very instrumental, I believe, in causing a lot of racial tension.
Well, and that's a very good point, you look at Barack Obama, you certainly look at Reverend Wright, you look at Michelle Obama, and she in particular seems to see everything through the prism of race. And I think as long as you've got the leadership in the United States looking at things through the prism of race, and you certainly see that with Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, Eric Holder and the like, how can we ever move past race as a predominant factor when viewing anything?
Well, but they don't want us to move past that because it really works for their benefit. If you can have this divide amongst the races and, you know, cause chaos, it works to their, you know, part of their agenda, which is just to, you know, keep us like that. And while we're sitting over there in that conflict, they're doing all kinds of things over here on the right-hand side that we're not even paying attention to. You know, the nuclear weapons treaty with Iran, TPP, you know, everything. But we're so busy and so focused over in the wrong place. And that's what they want.
And so listening to, you know, Michelle Obama, you get this sense of victimhood. We need another government program, and, you know, for a lot of black children, you know, and that's what she was saying here in this speech, you know, that she could remember growing up in part of Chicago and not feeling comfortable in museums and whatnot. So, you know, I think this was completely 100%, you know, the wrong message. You know, we would have liked to have heard is a speech about empowerment. And like you brought forth in your article, Susan, you know, we need to hear more about families. We need to hear more about the churches and church communities, and also about private organizations. This is really where you're going to find the solutions. Government is not the answer. And we would like to see, you know, more of a message about lifting up, you know, the individuals.
Well, and that's exactly – you're exactly right, because what this administration wants is, back to what we talked about before, bigger government, look to the government to take care of all of your needs. It's not your family. You know, we learned from Al Gore, you know, people over 35 are just stupid. We don't want to listen to them. It's not about your family. It's about us. We can tell you what foods you need to eat under Michelle's program. We can teach you the correct way under Common Core, you know. And I read an article the other day. I don't know if it's how accurate it is or anything else, but they were talking about looking into taking kids that really don't have a parent and try to put them into like a government-run boarding school to keep them 24/7. And I'm sitting there thinking, if you're a parent, you better be listening to that, because that is the next step in taking your children permanently.
But Susan, thank you so much for being with us. And please tell our listeners where they can find you and your articles as well.
Well, you can find all my information at SusanKnowles.com. That's SusanKnowles.com. The name of my radio show is Stand for Truth Radio. And like you said, it's here on WNJC 1360. And I write articles for The Blaze, and you can find that under the contributors on The Blaze. And I'm also a contributor for Joe for America as well.
Awesome. Well, Susan, we'd love to have you come back with us. Please take care. God bless.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, this is Jennifer Meadows along with Curtis Mang. You are listening to WNJC 1360, and we do want to take a quick break right here. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about several issues, one of which is the California drought and a few other issues as well. Please stick around. We will be back in just a few moments.
It feels like you're frozen, petrified. You're struggling with your mortgage payments. The bills begin to pile up. Not knowing what to do, you do nothing at all. And that's the worst thing you can do. Because if you take action, if you do something about your mortgage problems, you're far more likely to get the most positive outcome. Making Home Affordable is a free government program. Call 888-995-HOPE to talk one-on-one with a housing expert about the options that are right for you. Real help, real answers, right now. Call 888-995-HOPE or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov and do something about your mortgage problems. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Unexpected reactions to smart financial decisions brought to you by feedthepig.org.
Well, I finally did it. I opened a 401k.
So you're giving up? Just like that?
Giving up on what?
I'm getting an inheritance from a distant relative.
Don't you think if there were a billionaire in the family, we'd know about it by now?
Listen to me. We are one phone call away from riding horses on our own private polo grounds. One call from christening yachts, having a butler, using summer as a verb.
How do you figure?
Look, everyone's got a rich uncle somewhere. It's statistics. So the best thing you can do is just prepare for the inevitable.
Right. Which is why I thought maybe it would be smart to take control of my finances. You know, start using a budget, get out of debt, set some retirement goals.
Budgets? Debt? You watch your mouth. Retirement shouldn't be a goal for us. It should be a way of life.
When it comes to financial stability, don't get left behind. Get tools and tips for saving at feedthepig.org. This message brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
I find meaning the broken life. Of the freeway left me here alone. I may have lost my way now.
Live from Mississippi, here's Graceland with Jennifer Meadows.
We are listening to Graceland here on WNJC 1360 and from our TK Radio Network studios. I'm Jennifer Meadows with Curtis Mang, and we appreciate you listening to the program. And do want to take just a few minutes here to thank our sponsor, Communities Digital News. You can find them online at comdiginews.com. And now, you know, Obama, you know, we were talking a little bit about this in our opening, the opening of the show this evening. He's not real happy with Fox News. Specifically, their portrayal of the poor, but really, I think it's a whole lot more than that. But
agreed.
You know, and like I had said a little bit ago, our other co-host for the show, Charles Albert Johnson III, will be back with us next week. So, Charles, we will miss you. And but getting back to the situation here, that what we were talking about here in the opening, Curtis. So Obama, again, being critical of Fox News, not surprising at all. This time he's saying the portrayal of the poor, you know, is not correct. And Tuesday, he was at a summit on poverty saying he was going to basically change how media reports on these types of issues. So, Curtis, since you were here and Charles is not, let's talk about this. You know, what's going on? What's the real issue here between the president and Fox News?
Well, let me preface this by I can usually find sports analogies in almost any situation, and if not sports analogies, then movie analogies. And I found one as I was thinking about this. And there's a scene in Blazing Saddles where Mel Brooks plays Governor William J. LePetitmaine, and he's standing behind his desk, and he's got members of his cabinet sitting around his desk, and he's signing documents, and he's pontificating and making proclamations, and each time he pontificates, the members of his cabinet all collectively say "Harumph," except one guy, and then the governor points to him and says, "I didn't get a harumph out of that guy," and so I think that's how Obama views Fox News is. When he speaks, he doesn't get a harumph out of Fox News, as he does like with virtually every other mainstream media outlet. They report on how lousy the economy is. They report on the fact that, by God, there still are poor people. And if you look at NBC, ABC, CBS, poor people seem to disappear in Democratic administrations and only reappear when a Republican is elected president.
Mm-hmm. Exception of when it might be voting time, and then they're busing them to the polls, and that's one time you do see a lot of people that are in that strata of life. But I do believe that the biggest problem Obama has with Fox News and conservative media is the fact that we're actually out here telling the truth.
Exactly.
And he cannot take the littlest bit of criticism. And I have his transcript here from Tuesday when he was talking about this. He says, "I think that the effort to suggest that the poor are sponges or leeches, don't want to work or lazy or undeserving," he says, "has gotten traction. And look, it's still being propagated. And I have to say that if you watch Fox News on a regular basis, it is a constant venue." He says, "They will find folks who really make me mad," he says. "I don't know where they find them. They're all like, I don't want to work. I just want a free Obama phone or whatever." He says, "And that becomes the entire narrative that gets worked up." So, I feel there are a lot of people, and this is just my take on this. I think, we now are in a situation where there are a couple of generations now that have been living on government services. So, there are those people that do not want to work. That thought doesn't even, I think, enter their minds. But then there are others, because of Obama's wonderful socialist policies, that do not have jobs. So is this a fair statement that many people, poor people in the United States, do not want to work?
Oh, I think absolutely a fair statement. Are there working poor people who actually do go to jobs every day or attempt to go to find work every day? Absolutely. And they, they try to get by and so on. But there are an awful lot of people, as you say, who are multi-generational on government assistance. Their grandparents were on government assistance. Their parents, often in many cases, it's only one. It's not two in the home. on government assistance, and now they're on government assistance. So it is a multi-generational problem where you've got families that have never seen a family member have a job. And so I think that is a concern. And I think, if you look back at some of the things that the administration has said over the years, Barack Obama and his mouthpieces, if I recall correctly, they have said repeatedly that this administration doesn't pay attention to the, quote, cable news chatter, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it seems that they pay attention to that and little else sometimes. But as you rightly said earlier, I think actually Fox News and talk radio, including shows like this, have been the only ones in the media over the last 6.5 years that haven't just rolled over and said to the Obama administration, "Here, rub my belly." I think there's been no president since Kennedy that has had the fawning press coverage that Barack Obama has had. And yet, as you also rightly pointed out, he believes he is constantly being picked on.
Yep, I agree. And I think it just kind of shows the fact that, he is not able to take criticism, even of the mildest type. And,
mm-hmm.
Let's face it, the media, that's their role. You know, their role is to come out and comment and criticize, what's being said. And what president hasn't had this? Certainly George Bush. I mean, gosh, he was vilified in the media. But Obama has been very – since the beginning, since the onset, he's pretty much had a free ride. And what kills me here, getting back to this idea of poverty and how, Fox is putting forth this false, narrative, I guess, mm-hmm. on poverty. But Obama acts like he's one of the little people. And it kills me because – He's a Harvard educated, he's a Harvard graduate, and his kids are in the best private schools in Washington, D.C. He's worth millions. So, here's my question to you, Curtis. Do you actually feel that poor people in America see Barack Obama as one of them, that he's out there trying to champion the little guy?
Well, I think they did at one point, primarily based on his race, and he certainly played to that. I think in the 2008 election, and the 2012 election as well. Even though at that point he had a 4-year record to run on, but again, as I mentioned earlier, I think ran as if he had never been to Washington before. So I think there's a certain number. Percentage of the population, the poor population, that looked at him and said, "Okay, well, he's one of us. He's black. I mean, he must have some of the same experiences." Well, we talked last week about the goings on in Baltimore, and the week before, I think. Well, I don't think there are many in the inner city of Baltimore who have really any inkling of what growing up in a nice neighborhood in Hawaii is like. Barack Obama does, what it's like to spend some years growing up in Indonesia. They don't know that, but I'm sure Barack Obama does. So Barack Obama, I don't think, has a lot of experience in the inner city, except for the few years he spent as a, quote, community organizer, whatever that means.
Right. I completely agree with you. And I tell you this, there was actually an article about this out on Breitbart. And the part that concerns me about this entire thing was the fact that Obama, basically said, and I'm going to try to get the quote here. He says, "What is most revealing about the president's comments was that he expressed a desire to change how the media reports." And that's mm-hmm. what the president said himself. So my question to you is, we've seen all these attacks upon conservative media. you know, how, because I think he's kind of telling us a lot here. And so how do you think he's going to accomplish this? I feel that he wants to silence the voices on the right in the conservative media, whether it be Fox News or Breitbart or Jennifer and Curtis. So how is he going to accomplish this?
Well, I think you're right. And certainly, you know, you can't make a statement like, you know, we're going to have to change how the media reports without suggesting that there is some type of onerous control involved in doing such. And you know, we saw that to some extent, not with the media per se, but with conservative groups, with Lois Lerner and the IRS. You know, we can see it with the Justice Department when you've got the Justice Department following Fox's James Rosen around and monitoring his calls to his parents. You've got the potential with Obama pushing this net neutrality. So I think there all of those things and probably more are all attempts to silence the critics of not just Barack Obama, but with progressivism in general.
Now, I think and I'm agreeing with you, and I think, you know, it's not something that he would try to pursue through any kind of a bill or through Congress, because that would never happen. Mm-hmm. So I think looking at what's been happening with this net neutrality, I kind of see this as something that's going to be regulated very likely through the FCC, where they're very critical of conservative speech, whether it be hate speech or any other thing. So I think it will be regulated from that end, kind of like we've seen with the EPA and a lot of other regulatory agencies.
And if they can get away with it, they will.
Yes. Certainly will. So, but it is something we definitely need to keep an eye on. But thank you for listening to Graceland here on WNJC. I'm Jennifer Meadows here with Curtis Mang, and we're going to be moving into our next topic here and kind of change it to a little bit of a lighter topic as well. And so we've heard a lot about this drought in California, and so Curtis, in 60 seconds or less, tell us how did this whole thing with the drought? Give us a little background on that.
Okay, well certainly, and obviously, the lack of rain is a problem in California. But
yeah, you know, that's part of the problem.
Sure, but you know, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, California goes through periodic droughts, and they had an extended drought from 1929 to 34, 1976 and 77, 1987 to 92 was the last serious drought. Now, one of the differences between that now and then was that now there are 40 million residents during this drought, well over 10 million more than were in the state during the 1990s. And much of that growth is due to the massive and recent immigration. So you've got a large number of people, but thanks to in large part to environmentalists, there have been very little over the last 40 years as far as building or creating new storage projects, water storage projects, for example. And I'm reading some information from an article that Victor Davis Hanson wrote in the National Review from a couple of weeks ago. You know, for example, they stopped raising the Shasta Dam, the construction of the peripheral canal, and large projects such as the Apa and Dos Rios reservoirs. Those would have stored lots of water that would have been there in drought situations. You've also got what I find to be an incredibly bizarre situation where you've got reservoirs that do hold water, but you're releasing a lot of that water into the Pacific Ocean rather than sending it down to the Central Valley because it might harm a little tiny fish called the Delta smelt.
Right. That's right.
And so it makes no sense to me to send water that can be used for irrigation It can be used for drinking water. It can be used for any number of things into the Pacific Ocean because of a tiny little fish.
So, and what you see is, yes, we have had a drought in California, but has it been very much exacerbated by, again, we've seen this across the board. I don't care if we're talking about Ferguson or Baltimore or where have you. Take any of America's large cities. Well, and this is another situation where Democratic policies have made a drought situation much worse, all over a little bitty fish that looks like a sardine. Now, moving away from that, though, it's very interesting because as you pan the landscape, okay, you just go through and everything's dried up. The grass is burnt. I'm sure trees are dying. You've seen some of the most fertile areas of our country just drying up and blowing away. But not the case for Kim Kardashian's estate, and certainly not J-Lo or Barbara Streisand. So here you have the do as I say, but not as I do crowd. You know, so right. Many of these folks are big environmentalists. They talk about, you know, trying to save the planet and whatnot. So what do you have to say for that? I mean, it's typical liberal Hollywood hypocrisy, I suppose.
Well, and that's a very good way to put it. And I think, like so many things, particularly in California, you know, there are rules for most of the people, and then there are rules for the elite. And I think, you know, with the restrictions to the water usage in California, it apparently has a "don't you know who I am" clause. Mm-hmm. Where the celebrities, Barbara Streisand and the Kardashians and Kanye West, say, you know, essentially, you know, rules are for saps. I've won a Grammy. I got to water my lawn.
So, and here's the thing. It talked about $100 fine, but was it $100 fine? Is that a day or is that a month or what are we talking about?
I'm not sure. I think it's probably a month. Maybe it's a day, but really, does Barbara Streisand care if she's paying $100 fine per day even?
That's the thing. It's sad. I can't imagine paying $100 a day for someone watering my lawn. But it doesn't really say that. It says, but for residents in Los Angeles and wealthy enclaves, it says $100 fines for wasting water is chump change and a fee. But it doesn't really actually say how much that would be. So it might be a day per day. Who knows?
That's right. Exactly. You know, and if you're a middle class person living in, you know, El Centro or you know, Carlsbad, $100 a day means something to the Kardashians or someone like that. That's chump change.
Yeah, no, that's just dinner. That's lunch for Kim Kardashian. Yes. She's totally not worried about it. Well, our time is up here. Appreciate our listeners. Appreciate also Susan Knowles for being part of the show. But Curtis, please tell our listeners where they can go to follow you.
Certainly. I've got a website. It's mangwrites.com, MANGWRITES. I've got my books available there, and so check them out. And also JenniferMeadowsGraceland.com, and follow me on Twitter at Curtis Mang.
There you go. And you can follow me out on Twitter. That's JM Graceland, and also on Facebook. You can find our group. It's Graceland with Jennifer Meadows. And archives of this show are on TK Radio Network and also on comdiginews.com. But thank you for listening, Philadelphia. Take care. God bless. And until next time, have a great weekend.